Welcome to Heaven and Earth. I'm joined for the second time by Crawford Gribben, and we're here to, well, probably talk about various things, but in particular, Crawford's book, Survival and Resistance in Evangelical America, with the subtitle, which I actually think is quite important, at least to me, Christian Reconstruction in the Pacific Northwest. And the reason why I think the subtitle helps to make sense of what you mean by the main title, especially if you live in North America, because Reconstructionism, I don't know if I want to say it's very well known, but if you're in sort of Reformed theological circles, you may have heard of it at least. And so it kind of puts the pieces together. So I think as we get going, one of the really interesting things about your book is that you spent, I think, time in 2015, 2016 in, I want to say, Idaho, interviewing people and conversing. So you have this really, I don't know, but like a personal interaction with this group that I think makes you sympathetic. Is that the right word to use? More open to kind of being able to write about them in an objective way. So tell me a little bit about like those conversations. Like, so what, I know you went there for your research and for fun, I'm sure too, but what was that like just talking with people in this kind of survival movement out in the American Readout?
It was really interesting, wasn't it? You know, no doubt about it. You mentioned there the attempt of the book to try to be even-handed. So I wasn't trying to write something that was sympathetic or hostile. I think this is a movement that we say over here is a bit like Marmite. I don't know if you have Marmite in Canada. You ought to, but it's a spread on bread and cheese that people either love or hate. You know, and I think most people who write about this phenomenon write about it either as people who want to sort of, you know, praise it to the heavens, or indeed to condemn it to the nether regions. And I didn't really want to do that. I mean, I think it's relatively easy to do either of those two things, because I mean, if you want to criticize, there's no difficulty finding things to criticize. If you are inclined to see positives, you know, there's plenty of things to be positive about. So I didn't want to do that. I wanted to have the people speak very much for themselves, to represent their own ideas. And the way to do that, of course, is, you know, was to read as much of their material as I could, and then to go and meet people in situ, see what it's like, and see if what they say they're doing in their published materials corresponds to the way that they appear to be living. You know, when you actually go to their front door and sort of knock on it and say, hello, this is me. So, I mean, we had a great time. It was there 2015, 2016. A friend of mine, Scott Spurlock, who teaches at University of Glasgow, is from Coeur d'Alene. And Scott and I had a great time driving around summer of 2015. It was a strange summer. You might remember at that point in July, August, there was massive forest fires in that part of the world. Hundreds of thousands of square acres on fire, and they were shipping in firefighters from all over the world, you know, New Zealand and Australia, to try and help put this fire out. So, you know, when we got there, the first Saturday, I think, we went out fishing in Lake Ponderay, which is, you know, great if you're interested in fishing. Is it the deepest lake in North America, or the second deepest lake? It's incredible. But all around that lake was just burned out forest, you know, burned down houses. Took loads of pictures of it because I teach a course where I work in Belfast on apocalyptic movements. And I use those pictures of sort of burned out houses and so on as examples, as ways to contextualize how to study a movement that's preparing for disaster. And you visit it literally in the aftermath of disaster. And you know, it was just fascinating. But yeah, I mean, we sort of traveled around, chat to people from the Moscow, Idaho group that's led most famously by Doug Wilson, but a much wider range of people as well. Spoke to some people who identified themselves as kinists. So they're people who believe in racial segregation. There was a church of them that we spoke to. Other groups are sort of more militia orientated people, you know, doing all kinds of interesting and unusual things. So, you know, a fairly broad range of people. And what really the project was about triangulating two movements, both of which are promoting migration into the Pacific Northwest. One of them a movement that's very much church-led and encouraging people to come and be part of congregations. And then the other movement is very much survivalist in its orientation. And that's linked to some really big blogs on the internet, survivalblog.com and others. And they're also encouraging people to come into this area. So there's a very interesting overlap between these two movements. And it was that point of contact that we wanted to explore and eventually write up. That became the basis of this book.
Mm. So yeah, so maybe a better way to put it is you're letting people use their own voice to represent themselves as best you're able to do so. And this is through interviews. I think you talk about emailing even afterwards and through, reading the materials.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I was reading the materials for this, for the Moscow, Idaho group, really from the mid-1990s. And then Scott and I began to plan what we might want to do and cover about 2010. When we were both working in Dublin at the same place. And then about 2013, I began telephone interviews, for example, with James Wesley Rawls, who's one of the big survivalist bloggers and writers. And then 2015, 2016 was there in person. And then obviously following things again at a distance afterwards and writing up. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose to be completely honest with you, I haven't really followed what's happened in this group or in this movement in the last year or so, because I've been sort of preoccupied with some other things. But I follow them enough to see that the group that I thought were fairly marginal in the mid-1990s ended up being retweeted by President Trump in December last year. So they've moved from being really quite marginal to become really quite symbolic within the cultures of North American Reformed Evangelicalism, perhaps even Evangelicalism more generally.
Well, I know somewhere near the end of the book, you cite McVicker, who said that Reconstructionism is dead or theonomy is dead, whatever he said. But then you kind of make the point, well, okay, it's alive again, maybe in a new form. It's not exactly tied to theonomy in the same way maybe it used to be, but there is some sort of genealogical relationship. You know, Doug Wilson respects Rush Dooney and so on. It's interesting though, you mentioned that the president retweeted one of these groups. The way I don't know if I invented this, but I think I was in conversation with someone that we both know, but this group really does punch above its weight. Like you mentioned the survival blog, there's New York Times best-selling novels, Amazon Prime series.
Talk shows, yeah.
What'd you call it, sorry?
Talk show.
Yeah. And I didn't know about this, but like a Netflix children's program. Obviously YouTube, publishing through Canon Press or some of the other major, I think HarperCollins and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so like sometimes you think of maybe this Reconstruction movement, and I know you're kind of including all this, but in my brain, I'm isolating the religious side more just because that's the world I live in. Yeah, it's not huge numerically per se, but it's able to connect to a giant number of people outside of its immediate area. And even one practical thing is like, so this movement is saying retreat and let's do our own kind of schooling kind of deal. Well, yeah, so it's not the same thing as classical school or homeschooling. They're not equal signs, but yet, insofar as they promote those things, that's really feeding some of their agenda. Or things like, you mentioned it was really interesting to me, like the 10% flat tax, which was actually brought up probably in 2015 while you were in the US by, I don't remember the month offhand, but by one of the presidential candidates at that time.
Yeah, Ben Carson, wasn't it?
Yeah, right. Or is he presidential or was he just
he was running the party? Yeah, he was running for the Republican ticket, I think, at the time.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And so you have this relatively small group, I'm not saying they're tiny, but relatively small group that punches way above their weight and is even connecting to someone like me in Canada. Like I talked to you about how in my household, we had a book by Rush Dooney and so on. I guess that's a little bit different because that's prior in time. But so can you talk a little bit about that? Like how are they, like what's going on with this kind of international, like, output that they're having, even though they're a relatively small numerical group? Like what's going on?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a really interesting question, Wyatt. I mean, we were talking earlier on about the ways in which people in religious backgrounds, Christian backgrounds that are not Reconstructionists might still have access to Reconstructionist literature. And I think I mean, I think it's really important when you study religious movements, modern day religious movements, to remember that even though as historians or biblical studies people or whatever, we're trained to think systematically, most people approach theological meaning making as a kind of project of bricolage. So it's a bit of this and a bit of that. And then they try and work out how these different bits from different places fit together and what kind of, you know, what kind of shapes that are created as a consequence of that. And I think the question of the influence of these groups is really significant. You've seen it in Canada, in BC, in Alberta. I've seen it in the UK. When I picked up a copy of Gary North's book on the Ten Commandments, the economics of the Ten Commandments, inside it, I've still got it, inside it, there's a label indicating that it used to belong to the Royal Bank of Scotland Special Collections Unit archive. So how Gary North's book on the economics of the Ten Commandments got into some special bank archive in Edinburgh, I have no idea. Or there's probably even a story as to how it got from the special bank archive into the secondhand bookshop where I picked it up. That's maybe maybe another story of mergers and acquisitions. I don't know. But, you know, the you mentioned Mike McVicker's book, which is an excellent book, a really good biography of R.J. Rushdoony, and well worth reading if anyone's interested in his life story. Another really good book is by by Julie Ingersoll, and it's just called Christian Reconstruction. Her book, sorry, is called Building God's Kingdom, but it's a great book too. And she documents in that from the perspective of a religious studies scholar who used to be inside the movement. She documents visiting lobbying organizations in Washington and seeing shelves full of Christian Reconstructionist materials. So, the real kind of hardcore Reconstructionist material is circulating, often in surprising places. But it also circulates in modified, diluted form through people like Francis Schaeffer. Now, Francis Schaeffer had quite a peculiar relationship, I think, to R.J. Rushdoony's writing. And there's been various debates over the years as to exactly the level of dependency that Francis Schaeffer had on R.J. Rushdoony's work. So that's an open question. I don't go into that in the book. I just draw attention to the fact that there's a question there that still needs a proper answer. So you get the hardcore stuff, you get the diluted stuff, but then I think you also get the stuff that just sort of seeps out into broader evangelicalism, not as an idea system, but as bits and pieces of an idea system that sort of floats around in the flotsam and jetsam of evangelicalism, and people pick it up and put it all together. And so, you know, they might be a good dispensationalist expecting the rapture at any moment and so on, but when you push the right buttons, they'll say to you, well, yes, but of course we need to have godly government. And of course the Bible should guide us as to what that government should look like. So, you know, the classic example of that is someone like Pat Robertson, who, you know, is obviously a major TV religious personality, dispensationalist, also charismatic. That's a separate issue. But writes and talks very forcibly about what godly government ought to look like. And, you know, according to the historical theologians, people shouldn't really be operating like that. They should be, you know, straightforwardly dispensational or straightforwardly reconstructionist. But actually, a lot of people are bits and pieces of a lot of different kinds of things. As to the influence of the group in Moscow, Idaho, I think you're right. I think it is a really small group. There's about 2,000 people there. What's 2,000 people out of the 20 to 30 to 40 million people in the United States who claim to be evangelical Christians? I mean, it's a drop in the bucket. And yet, when you look at the really small number of people in that group of 2,000 people in Moscow, Idaho, who are actively writing and shaping opinions, and then begin to track the networks of influence that they have within this broader Reformed evangelical, or even more broadly evangelical culture, I think you can begin to work towards conclusions that would be really quite astonishing. You mentioned Doug Wilson's Amazon Prime talk show called Man Rampant. It's done a couple of seasons now. Obviously, you know, they started out publishing books under their own imprint, Canon Press, but they have gone on to publish books with, you know, really major publishers. And And I think what's so remarkable about this is that they have done it largely by standing at a critical distance from the main vehicles of influence within evangelicalism. They've done it very much in their own terms. So, you know, if you go back to the 1990s, when I sort of became aware of this group for the first time, they were designing their own magazine using desktop publishing software, printing their own books for the very first time that were mainly lifted, as far as I could see, mainly lifted from articles published in that magazine. And it was like a kind of indie culture or like a punk rock culture, do-it-yourself culture of a very idiosyncratic reformed resurgence in the context of the great institutional gatekeepers of evangelicalism, who really wanted nothing to do with the kind of weird ideas this group in Moscow, Idaho was developing. So the group in Moscow, Idaho were reading, you know, the same kinds of materials, often in a much more stringent, much more straightforward way, and, you know, taking Banner Truth books very much at face value and just running with it and seeing what happened. And, you know, I think that you have this kind of image, I suppose, of a kind of a punk rock reformed resurgence in a really obscure, out of the way part of the country that 25 years later, its members are co-writing books with people like Christopher Hitchens, getting, you know, Amazon Prime talk shows, Netflix children's shows, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's an extraordinary story.
One of the fascinating, just as a practical side note, is a lot of times people kind of criticize the simple kind of online writing that many people do, but this kind of practice is actually how you become a good writer. And maybe early on, where they're in this little imprint, they're beginning to kind of hone their skill so that they're ready to have the ability to kind of print with these bigger publications. One thing I also think is interesting is that you kind of talk about Francis Schaeffer, Pat Robbins, these names of how interrelated things can be. I think you might mention this in your book, but I believe Hal Lindsey had a center in California that Rush Dooney spoke at. It was like the Friends for Jesus or something to that effect. Yeah. And it's like, so Hal Lindsey and Rush Dooney are in a building together. It's just odd because one is Mr. Dispensational and one is Mr. Theonomy, you know, like the two
kind of
icons of those different movements. And yet they both kind of have a similar view that the end is nigh. But one says the end is nigh, so we raptured. The other one says, so that we can reconstruct, you know?
Yeah.
So, and he kind of mentioned that already, but like, can you kind of just like, you mentioned this kind of intermixture of ideas, but like, is there, you've done dispensational research. Is there a connection? Is it theological? Is it maybe just cultural? Like what's going on in terms of this? I'll give you one brief example. In my own household, we had dispensational literature and then we had ideas and Rush Dooney at the same time as well. Like that was just fine. Same. And James Dobson was there too. Like we can have all of them under one household and nobody thought it was at that time odd.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a very good observation, Wyatt. Again, I go back to the point that historical theologians, people who write historical theology, are very happy to lay out systems of thought, but they want people to be as organized as the ideas are, but people aren't that organized. They're just not. And, you know, I think you're right. Rush Dooney and Hal Lindsey are two very different people with very different sets of ideas. However, Rush Dooney was a lot more consistent than Hal Lindsey was. Because Hal Lindsey, you know, for all that we think of Hal Lindsey as a representative dispensationalist, Hal Lindsey really began to mold the dispensational tradition and actually to turn it 180 degrees on some of the claims that he was making. So, you know, previous to 1948, you know, the establishment of the State of Israel, dispensationalism had always argued there are no signs of the times. The next event in the prophetic calendar is the rapture. After 1948, a number of big name dispensationalists begin to prevaricate in that possibility because they want 1948 to mean something prophetically. However, it's left to Hal Lindsey in 1970 really to make that argument with force, which he does in the late Great Planet Earth. But he does more than that. So he moves dispensationalism from futurism to partially historicism. But more than that, he also begins to argue very forcefully that we should be voting for Christian politicians and that those Christian politicians are responsible to create a Christian America. So what was he doing then when he was inviting R.J. Rushdoony to come to the Jesus Christ Light and Powerhouse on the UCLA campus? Well, I can only imagine he wasn't there, because Rushdoony's talk, which he published later on in one of his Chalcedon Institute magazines, or in two of them actually, it was a pretty searing critique of dispensationalism. It was a talk called Dominion Man, or what was it called again? Despair Man or Dominion Man, something like that. But I mean, it was very much me versus Hal Lindsey, and you know, and the sort of hippie Christians there were being asked to choose between which of the two ways into the future they wanted. So, I mean, Hal Lindsey was inviting a lot of people to the Jesus Christ Light and Powerhouse to talk to these students. I mean, he must not have realized who he was inviting when he invited R.J. Rushdoony, because Rushdoony by that point had published a post-millennial commentary on Daniel and Revelation, and was already, I think he'd already published at least the first volume of his Institutes of Biblical Law. What's that, 700-900 pages long? An exegesis of Exodus 20, showing how each of the Ten Commandments needs to relate to present day policy. So, I mean, I think that the point you're making, Wyatt, is that nobody's consistent. But I think Hal Lindsey isn't either. So, you know, I think maybe we're all in good company.
That title is interesting to me, because it just strikes me that movement sometimes is a bit strident. And so, you know, you talk about how there's inconsistency and there's maybe a post-1948 movement among dispensationalists to affect society, like the moral majority is part of this. I have a weird baptism history, but I'll give you one part of it. I was baptized in Thomas Road Baptist Church when Jerry Falwell Sr. was there. And after my baptism, he gave me a big hug. And I distinctly remember suffocating in his body. So from death to life to near death again. Yeah. But that, he was very much a part of that. He's a dispensationalist. He has to be. I assume he is. And as part of that moral majority movement that is really trying to affect politics. But I believe you must note it in a different way than the Reconstructionists are, because the moral majority, and even whatever's left of it today, which is, I don't know what's left of it, anything, but like whatever's going on is not really influencing anymore, but it's this kind of, I don't know, like the top-down approach maybe is a way to put it. And then the Reconstructionist group is almost like a bottom-up approach. So
very much so.
Can you describe like those two emphases, how they differ, and I don't know, just make sense of it?
Well, I think you're right, Wyatt. So, you know, traditionally, whenever evangelicals thought about reclaiming America or that kind of project, they would often think of it as a top-down project. So they, you know, their tools were the tools of politics. America would be saved if enough people voted for the right candidates. That's pretty much what they expected. And so they enter the political arena and they play the political arena according to the rules of the political arena, which are about raising money, about lobbying, about learning how to communicate your big ideas, and about identifying the candidates that you can trust to put into positions of great power in the expectation that they will do something for you. So the whole relationship is transactional. We'll support you if you do this for us. And, you know, obviously 1976 election, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, both claiming to be evangelicals. Carter gets elected. He's a good Southern Baptist. But what happens with Roe v. Wade? Nothing. So then the evangelicals move to support this, you know, very talented, very charismatic Republican from California, Ronald Reagan, gets him elected. And what happens? Well, nothing. So, you know, it doesn't take long, I think, for the penny to drop among certain evangelicals that this transactional method of doing politics and getting Christian influence through votes and lobbying and all that kind of stuff, it just doesn't work, because that's not how politics works. You know, you mix religion with politics, politics always wins. It's as simple as that.
What's fascinating, so, there's the evangelicals for Biden.
Yeah.
And I don't remember all the details, but I think they've recently been disappointed in how the budget's been organized and what it's supporting.
Well, so it's, yeah, I mean,
it wasn't a good transaction, I guess.
Well, welcome to historical, you know, reality. I mean, evangelicals supported Trump and were disappointed by Trump. It doesn't matter who they lend their support to. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help, is what Isaiah says. I mean, that is what politics is all about. It's about going to Egypt for help. So, you know, the group that gathered in Moscow, Idaho, then I think saw pretty quickly that the American way of doing politics was never going to bring about the kingdom of God in there. And really from the late 90s onwards, quite a number of other people associated with the moral majority, I think also came to see that there was no moral majority. That actually, you know, this whole enterprise, the Moscow Idaho people were very much within that mindset. And you know, through the late 90s, early 2000s, their attitude was very much, you know, let's just withdraw from politics. Politics is not really something, it's not the vehicle that we need to realize what we expect will be realized. And what they were doing there, I think, was applying their post-millennial expectations to social and political responsibility. So unlike the premillennialists, the Moscow Idaho Christians really did believe that America would become a Christian nation. And in fact, that its prospects were brighter and brighter. Despite the short-term tribulation, looking at the longer term, things were going to get better and better. And how was that going to happen? Well, they said it's not going to be through moral majority political transaction making. It's going to be done through, you know, the means of grace. How's that for a radical idea? You know, the world will be made better, not by voting or huckstering at polls, but actually just by preaching, praying, leading holy lives, building Christian families, strong congregations, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's not rocket science, but yet I think the moral majority had completely lost sight of that they put their hopes on political activity. The Moscow Idaho group said that's obviously not going to work. We don't need to lobby America to become a Christian nation because Jesus has died in order to make it so. And in fact, not only has he died in order to make it so, but the prophets in the Bible predict that the nations of the world will come and give their allegiance to Jesus Christ. So then, you know, it's on that basis that Doug Wilson can write things in the little group's magazine, Credenda Agenda, with statements like Jesus is the King of Idaho. You know, and people just need to recognize that. So the approach there was very much bottom up. So a bottom up approach is never going to show quick results. And it didn't in Moscow, Idaho. The group grew, but it grew very slowly. You know, over 20, 30 years, it's 40 years even, it's grown to number about 2,000. But it's also begun to extend its influence elsewhere. And that, of course, is really significant. But they have done all of this without really getting involved in politics in any way. In fact, when I was there in summer 2015, I think, or was it 2016, that was the year when the congregation entered the local political arena for the very first time. So it had been established in the late 70s, early 80s, and they waited until 2015 or 2016 to have one of their members stand for election to the local farmers market. So this is not exactly a takeover of City Hall, you know. So it's very, very, you know, very slow, low-key politically, not low-key in terms of publicity, but not, you know, not grasping for power in a way that I think a lot of the drive-by books, you know, that are sort of to kind of a hot take on dominionism is often the preferred term these books like to use. You know, it's not grasping for power. In fact, it's almost the antithesis of that. It's looking for slow, organic, developmental growth over generations. And I think like lots of Reconstructionists, they are content to play a very long game. But I think now, what, 40 plus years into their existence in Moscow, Idaho, they are beginning to see the results of that. And I think the results are, you know, by any estimation, quite extraordinary.
I mean, part of that too explains why there's a preference for libertarianism,
yeah,
and often a pushback against liberal democracy. So libertarianism basically is decentralized governments. There's no big control from up here. So that allows the bottom up to kind of take effect. And liberal democracy is the view that like anything goes, right, in terms of views. And if that's around, that's not really going to be good for the long term once there's a sufficient threshold for us to begin to kind of create a society around governed by kind of biblical law. I thought that was a fact, because it is true. I mean, anecdotally, it's true that if I think of Reconstructionism or theonomy, which I know are a bit different, but they often kind of seem connected, libertarianism seems close at hand, or at least anti-democracy. Is that too general, or is that pretty fair to say that?
I think that's pretty fair, Wyatt. And I think that goes back to the very roots of the Reconstructionist movement. Argyris Dooney cut his political teeth in the 1960s working for the Volcker Foundation, which was a libertarian foundation. And, you know, that's where he made a lot of his early contacts. But he grew disenchanted, I suppose, by libertarianism, because he realized that the kind of libertarianism that these ungodly people were promoting wasn't really going to deliver the kind of society that he was expecting to arrive. So I think the Reconstructionists do something with libertarianism. It's not like the libertarianism of some of the major figures, you know, drop out, smoke weed, do whatever you want to do. That's really not what Rush Dooney was interested in. He wanted to reduce the number of laws in the statute book. So, you know, that looks a lot like libertarianism. He was prepared to think in quite radical ways, I think, about the future of policing and prisons. In fact, he was prepared pretty much to do away with both. But he was happy to see the number of laws in the statute books reduce, as long as the laws that were left in the statute books were biblical laws or laws explicitly derived from scripture. So it was both a project to decentralize, yes, but also to limit the accretion of law, while also pointing the construction of law towards scripture as an authoritative source. So that, I mean, I think that takes care of the libertarian argument. The other argument then is about the value of liberal democracy. And of course, I mean, this is a really interesting issue, because there's been any number of calls over the last 5 years among Christians of various kinds to rethink the roots of the classical liberal order, whether it's Patrick Deneen's book, Why Liberalism Failed, or some other Catholic writings which are calling for the reintegration of church and society.
Is this integralism? Is this the kind
of... exactly, yeah. You know, that's the Catholic version of what Reconstructionism is for the Reformed. So, I mean, some of these people are very, very influential. People who teach law at major Ivy League institutions. People who teach politics at major American institutions as well. So, you know, there's a real sort of crisis. I think it's one of the Trumpian effects, isn't it, on assumptions about conservatism. But I think a lot of American conservatives now, especially Catholics, are very worried about liberal democracy. And in some ways, they're just catching up with what Rush Dooney's been saying for a long time.
What's interesting to me, that, like, so if you're a Baptist, one of your distinctives is the separation of church and state, which sort of implies the need for something like a liberal democracy, some sort of government that doesn't impose an established church, whether that's a Muslim, Buddhist, whatever it is. Like, it just, but then you do see a kind of a shift. Like, I know there's you probably know his name, but John MacArthur has recently on a number of occasions criticized freedom of religion of late. And it strikes me, it's like, oh, okay, this is a little bit like theonomy, right? A little bit, because if the idea is that freedom of religion and expression means you can do whatever you want and it's not important to follow God, well, maybe we don't want that. Maybe we want there to be a kind of a biblical religion in North America. And I kind of wonder if there's a bit of a crisis point, at least in North, I don't know about Ireland, but in North America where, okay, look, we had basically Christendom until like 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And so you could do whatever you wanted, and there was still this baseline Christianity wherever you went.
Yeah.
But now, I mean, if you're born in the 2000s, like it's unclear that you'd be born in any kind of Christian community, at least in Canada. Yeah. There's some rare cities, but it doesn't feel Christian, right? It feels liberal. And in the US, I mean, I think you have holdouts, I'm sure. So then even if you're kind of more dispensational or very separation of church and state and just let them do what they want, you're seeing the effects of this kind of breakdown of what's the right word, but this kind of monoculture, a breakdown of monoculture. That's a bad way to put it, I'm sure, but you can use a smart word to explain what I'm talking about. And so then you're kind of scrambling to figure out, well, how do we put the pieces back together? And I kind of wonder if you'll see a lot more of the Reconstruction ideas, like 10% tax, all kind of stuff, further influence in this kind of spiral movement, our evangelical movement in North America. Because I don't know that we have good solutions to the problems that we're seeing. I mean, obviously, we focus on gospel and building strong congregations. That's good. But then at the institutional level, I'm not sure we have a lot going on, at least as I understand it.
Yeah. I mean, those are really interesting observations. I suppose you could say that the Baptist position on church-state relations was formed in a very particular historical period and culture in which more or less everybody basically accepted Christian norms. So it's relatively easy for Baptists to argue in the 17th or 18th century, even if they're being persecuted by the state, that there should be equality between denominations and no denomination privileged over another, when everyone more or less believes the same things anyway, at least ethically. But what happens when you reach post-modernity or whatever we're in now, where, you know, where the simplest assertions are going to be denied or qualified by someone else? You know, liberal democracy, I think to a lot of its critics, only works when there's a cohesive culture behind it. But what happens when there's no cohesive culture? If people can't agree on how they know things or what they know, then there's no real common ground for people to come together. And then I think you get people, I mean, I don't know about John MacArthur, but certainly these other groups, they're looking at passages like Romans 13 or 1 Peter 2 that speaks about the civil magistrate being God's servant to execute wrath and the evildoer and to reward the good. You know, that doesn't really sound like liberal democracy. That sounds like something else. And if we're voting for Stephen Harper, then, you know, maybe we know what we're voting for. But, you know, if it's Justin Trudeau, he might have a very different way of viewing the world. Is he still a servant of God to execute wrath on the evildoer? Well, who's going to tell him that? And what standard are they going to ask him to impose? And that, I think, you know, really does begin to throw up lots of big questions. So, I mean, I don't really get surprised that Baptists are now questioning traditional Baptist formulations of church-state relations, because I just don't think that they're workable anymore. And, I think much bigger searching questions are going to have to be asked.
Well, it is interesting. So I was reading this little bio on Origen of Alexandria this morning, and the culture he lives in is so much diversity in terms of views. Valentinians, whatever it is, all these different groups. There's legalists, there's Jewish, Greek, all pagans, etc. So this hugely diverse culture. And he's really trying to reaffirm, like, what is the church's teaching? And I kind of wonder if we're in a time like that again. Like, there's really no king in Israel, as in we don't have the Pope in Rome who can kind of consolidate agreement among evangelicals. I mean, I could talk to Christians across my city right now, and they might not even recognize the Athanasian Creed. Probably wouldn't, almost certainly wouldn't. Like, it's just not even a thing to adjudicate our differences. And then you kind of, it's interesting in history. I mean, you have the Constantinian establishment where, okay, well, Constantine didn't really like mold theology, but he also made people get together and work it out. And then in the English Reformation, you obviously had Henry and so on. But even in the Swiss city-states, the cantons had their own, I mean, the church was the city, right? Like, or the Lutherans had princes. And so really, it's interesting historically, you almost need a prince to listen to you after there's a big mission movement to bring the chaos back into order. And so you talk about Romans 13. Well, you have magistrates, which are called basically priests, servants on behalf of God. And I think they essentially bring peace and order, but it might actually be, if we follow the magisterial reformers, the real sense in which they are maybe helping to organize our religious chaos. So we'll have to see what that looks like. In Canada, we're not going to get a magistrate who will listen to us. So I don't know. Maybe in 50 years, maybe not. I think you look at global Christianity, it's very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think the shakeup is going to come from China. If China, you know, if current growth continues, China will be the world's biggest Christian nation by 2030. So that's less than 10 years away. So what will the global religious order look like when the nation with the largest Christian influence is actually communist?
Yeah, will democracy be kind of equated with Christianity at that point? Crawford, we should probably finish our time here. We mentioned some books. Beyond your book, Survival and Resistance in Evangelical America, and I'll put in the show notes, what are other things that we can read? We mentioned McVicar on Christian Reconstruction.
Yeah, Michael McVicar is really, really good. It's a biography of R.J. Rushdoony. It's fascinating, sometimes very sad story. But I think Michael does it really well, and it's very, very careful and very nicely done. Julie Ingersoll's book on building
God's Kingdom.
That's right. Which is a kind of a history of Christian Reconstructionism more generally. It's a great piece of research as well. She writes as someone who used to be involved in the movement, and has since taken on a much more critical position as a religious studies scholar. Those are the two books I'd really recommend. And then I think if anybody wants to sort of dip their toes into seeing what all the fuss is about, Rushdoony is worth a read. I think Rushdoony is a really significant thinker.
So where would you start with Rushdoony? Would you probably not his institutes, I'm guessing.
Yeah, actually, why not? Why not start an institutes? I mean, there's so much, he's written so much. But the Institutes of Biblical Law lays everything out in one place, and you will see things there which are startling and terrifying, perhaps. But I think it will give you a really good idea of what he's about. But it will also, I think, help you to realize that he's not necessarily saying all the bad things that people say he says. Certainly says things that people will find troubling. But he's certainly not calling for revolution, quite the opposite. And then, you know, the stuff that's coming out of Moscow, Idaho, I think is repackaging a lot of those ideas, reworking some of them sometimes in fundamental ways, but I think also repackaging them and making them much more accessible and engaging. And anyway, there's a mountain of stuff, literally a mountain of stuff to wade through if people are interested in doing that.
Well, thank you, Crawford. I appreciate the book and then also the conversation.
It's great to see you again. Thanks for your time.